Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us again. Sunday morning wake-up call. And today, finally, post-election 2020. And I say finally as if we can talk about that in a final manner, and I don't think we can yet, but we didn't do it last Sunday because where were we going to go? What were we going to talk about? But today, at least, we have a little more information, a lot more conversation. Our guest today, Professor Daniel Gingrich. He's a professor of politics. He specializes in comparative politics. He also directs University of Virginia's CLEAR Lab, which is Corruption Laboratory for Ethics, Accountability, and the Rule of Law. A second guest, Professor Justin Kirkland, also a professor of politics and policy, specializing in American politics. His research centers on representation, legislative politics, state politics, and public opinion. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rick. I've been told I have a face for radio, so I'm delighted to be in my natural medium.
Well, you know, I think you make at least a second person on the show today who qualifies as that. That's how I've gotten away with doing this for long enough. So let's jump right into it. We have Professor Gingrich and Professor Kirkland from UVA's Department of Politics. So we have the election, which is just about 2 weeks ago. And I will tell folks, we are pre-recording this. So if something happens between the date that we're recording it and the day that we're airing it, please forgive us. But at this point, we have no officially announced winner. And by that, it's because President Trump has yet to concede, and the department, and you can announce this, the department that officially announces President-elect Biden as the winner so that he can have all the government funding and other issues, other goodies that he can have to begin his role. That department has not announced him the winner either. So when we have a very split country, when folks went to bed on election night, folks in blue went to bed as there was no blue wave. What kind of sick country is accepting of a damaging president? And on Wednesday morning, and still, the folks in red who voted for President Trump say there's no obvious victory because of fraud. What is going on the academic side of things with all of this?
I guess I'll chime in quickly. I think those sort of sentiments in the moment are sort of not a giant surprise to those of us who sort of study elections and study public opinion. You know, going into the race, there was good reason to believe that it was going to be a relatively close outcome that hinged on a few states. And so the sort of uncertainty that people were feeling late Tuesday into Wednesday morning, I think is sort of naturally coming with closely divided elections. And there was, I mean, there were some folks who I think maybe suspected a giant blue wave was coming, but I think most academic researchers were sort of in the camp that we're a narrowly divided country. And so the odds that you were going to see some giant referendum were relatively low from our perspective. I'll also say that the accusations of fraud have mostly been met with incredulity amongst academics. There's not a ton of evidence floating around that any meaningful fraud has taken place. So we're more skeptical of those sort of concerns changing anything in a meaningful way.
And yeah. Professor Gingrich, what have you found?
So, I would say that it's helpful when thinking about the lack of a blue wave to decouple the results from the presidential election from those of the down ballot races. Actually, if we're looking at the results for the presidential election, you know, both in terms of the popular vote and in terms of the likely number of states that it seems Biden has won by this point, it's actually a pretty decisive victory by recent historical standards in the United States. That victory did not translate into overwhelming support for the Democratic Party per se. So one way to read the results, and I think it's fair to read the results this way, is that it is by and large a repudiation of the Trump administration by a significant proportion of the population of the United States. But that repudiation of the Trump administration did not translate into an overarching embrace of what is perceived of as the agenda of the Democratic Party.
Well,
and just sorry, Rick, just one other point, because I think it is really important to speak about this fraud issue. I just want to reiterate what my colleague stated. Academics so far have seen no convincing evidence of fraud. And I would say that the judges to whom accusations of fraud have been brought at this point have also seen, so far as we're aware, no convincing evidence of fraud. And so I'm somebody who studies politics in developing countries, in Latin America in particular. Throughout the 20th century, sadly, we've seen many instances of contested elections subsequently resulting in the collapse of democracy. It is very important for polities to have stable democracies that they have something called loyal oppositions, which means opposition parties that fight hard to get into government, but when they lose, they accept the results of legitimately cast ballots. They accept the results of elections. And I think an interesting thing for us to talk about is indeed, are we at the point now where one of the major parties in the United States is perhaps frighteningly veering into a position of being a disloyal opposition party, one that is not willing to abide by the results of democratic elections.
Professor Gingrich and Professor Kirkland as well, but Professor Gingrich, you mentioned things being pretty closely split overall, a little more than in years past, but similar. But I went back and I pulled up, I went back to the John F. Kennedy race and coming forward. And there are, it looks like that the even split of pretty close to 50% on either side of the vote starts around the George W. the second Bill Clinton administration. But you can go further back and find that even when there's a 50% popular vote, that the electoral vote can be outrageously different. Ronald Reagan won with 50.75% in his first administration and had nearly 91% of the electoral vote. And that's not the only one that I can choose from, but I'm curious as to what might have happened in the Bill Clinton time frame in that administration that would have set things off to make such an even 50% split in our country. And then I'd like to get into this popular vote versus electoral vote.
Dan, do you want to go first or should I?
I'll let you jump. You jump in first.
Yeah. So what's interesting about that split, and you're right, is that there's sort of an odd and maybe not directly correlated relationship between the popular vote and electoral college votes, and that relationship has changed over time in interesting ways. That transition, we think, has to do with two things, and that is sort of an increasing level of partisanship and polarization amongst sort of the average American public, along with the fact that that partisanship seems to be related to how we as Americans occupy geographic space, where the sort of partisan divide between Democrats and Republicans is becoming increasingly a divide between urban and rural communities. And so that means that, you know, you can win an urban, heavily populated state by a large margin, but not get the commensurate electoral college votes that might come with it. Or you could spread votes out more efficiently over space and win races 55-45, but pick up 100% of the electoral college votes across lots of places. That's changed over time because the relationship between partisanship and urban versus rural communities has changed in interesting ways. And so the takeoff of polarization in the 90s, when paired with the urban-rural divide amongst voters growing more strong and more stark, is what triggers that kind of disconnect between electoral votes and popular votes and the shift in those relationships over time.
Yeah, I mean, I would reiterate everything that Justin has said, and in particular state that the increasing political relevance of density seems to play a remarkably important role in the way in which votes are translated, votes cast for president are translated into electoral college votes, and more generally, how votes cast for particular parties for congressional elections are actually translated into seats in Congress.
Yeah, so I mean, this is sort of more anecdotal than it is sort of strictly academic, but a number of folks in my social circles think hard about like how, you know, if we're thinking on the side of the Democrats, how bad for the Democratic Party a state like California might actually be, because there's like a surplus of several million Democratic voters in California that could be distributed, you know, out in other rural states or in other Midwestern states while keeping California comfortably Democratic. And so you can build up a very large popular vote lead there without necessarily gaining the same amount of electoral votes if you had the same number of voters distributed across other states. So
I think this raises an interesting question. Maybe I want to ask Justin and then we'll go, you know, just have a general conversation about it. So the question is, what is actually happening here, right? Is it that density itself is having an independent causal impact on this process, meaning density itself is somehow driving these voting patterns, or is it simply that the Democratic Party, for whatever reason, is not as attractive to the white working class as it was in previous decades. And that particular segment of the population is concentrated in areas that are less dense, and it is equally as popular as it was in the past, or more so among more diverse communities or communities of color in the United States, and they happen to be located in areas where there's higher levels of density. So the question is, what is actually driving this process? Is it the changing demographic constituencies of the parties, or is it something about being in rural versus urban areas, irrespective of those other components of social identity?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both of those things happening at the same time. So I think, you know, in the 1970s, when we start to see partisan sorting, that is, you know, conservatives in the Republican camp and liberals in the Democratic camp, really take off, that that sort of starts to bring the sort of white working class voter into the Republican Party at slowly elevating rates, along with the sort of slow decline of unions and labor movements in the U.S., you know, moving white working classes further into the Republican Party. But there's also pretty good evidence to suggest that in a kind of contact theory, a diffusion sort of framework, that like living in a dense area surrounded by other people who think a particular way about politics can cause you to wander into their camp. Right. So where you start out with sort of small imbalances in the urban-rural partisanship structure, right, over time, those can reinforce themselves to pull urban and rural voters further and further apart, which I think is sort of why you see this stuff kind of start out slow in the 70s and 80s, and then, as Rick talked about, really taking off in the 90s and the 2000s, because that sort of initial difference starts to compound itself further and further and further.
So essentially, you're talking about a process of geographical sorting.
Right. So you wind up with a sort of initial weak sort, right, that's based on geography that can, you know, via continuous contact and being surrounded by people of, you know, if you're in a city, of similar liberal mentalities, or if you're in a rural area of more conservative mentalities, causes you to kind of reinforce those aggregate differences.
Professor, let me ask you real quick. We've got to take a break in just a minute or two. But I read about something similar to that called the filter bubble, where algorithms, what does it say here? Algorithms skew the variety of information we get online in favor of stuff we already like, meaning less exposure to divergent viewpoints. It's not just the people you hang out with.
Yep.
It's the things that come across your Facebook page to read, to buy, to and all of that. It's the friends that they focus on. You know, I'm sure everybody saw that piece on Facebook about, hey, if you want to see more of your friends and not just this 25, you need to go to your settings and do all this. But it's similar to that. The filter bubble, is that what you're talking about here?
Yeah, so...
Only you're talking about doing it with your social friends rather than what you're reading?
Yeah, so there's both this sort of social sorting mechanism and this sort of online sorting mechanism that can reinforce these sort of maybe initially minor differences, right? And so, yeah, on YouTube or on Facebook, these are companies that are trying to show you things that they think you like, so that, you know, you'll click on it and you'll generate ads, and that will generate money for them, but limits your exposure to competing viewpoints. The same thing happens to Americans in their social circles, right? That, you know, as their sort of slight imbalances in your urban friends, right, you're going to get more sort of liberal discussion points in your Friday night beers, right? And that's going to sort of slowly, similarly reinforce your ideology in the same way that sort of online filter bubbles reinforce your ideology. That's exactly right.
All right, let's take our first break. We'll come back. Certainly lots to talk about today, post-election 2020, with our guest, Professor Daniel Gingrich and Professor Justin Kirkland from UVA's Department of Politics. Hang tight, everyone. And thanks for being with us again today, Sunday morning. Professors, and I think I'll start with Professor Kirkland on this one. We also have Professor Daniel Gingrich with us today, Professor Justin Kirkland. Do we know why so many people voted to reject an incumbent president? And then why did so many people support a president with all the blame he has received in the media?
Sure. I mean, so do we know why? Sort of, I guess, is what I'd say. Mostly. So why did so many people reject an incumbent president? I guess in the time since the election has happened, I've actually found some of the from a political science standpoint, some of the results comforting, right? So we would have expected that a president with relatively low public approval and relatively high unemployment in the wake of a kind of global crisis to shed some voters, right? We would have expected that those peripherals would have hurt a president in a subsequent election. And that's sort of ultimately what we saw, is that there's a pretty significant popular vote gap between the president and the Vice President Biden. So I think that's sort of in keeping with how we've thought about presidential elections for a long time. I think the sort of reverse question is sort of an interesting one, given the sort of state of the economy and the state of the country. Why did President Trump maybe overperform his polling averages? And I think you can chalk a lot of that up to pretty strong and healthy partisanship in the country, that the Republican Party voters, we have increasing survey evidence that suggests that their willingness, this goes for both parties, their willingness to vote across party lines is dropping rapidly. And so the number of cross-party voters that you find in 2020 is significantly lower than it was in 2000, which was significantly lower than it was in 1980. So the president's performance and approval rating are in some ways becoming unstuck from the sort of conditions that we find ourselves in. Why don't people blame the president? Because they don't see the problems that surround them as being connected to the president in any meaningful way anymore.
You know, I have friends who voted for President-elect Biden, and they say nobody ever voted. He received more votes than anyone ever. And I say, and he also had more people vote against him than anyone ever. I mean, it's who are you voting for, and what viewpoint do you want to take about it?
So, Rick, I mean, I think the point that you just made is kind of one that's easily to address, right? There's a difference between the size of a country's population and the number of voters that turn out to vote one way or the other, and their preferences for one specific candidate or another, right? Clearly, the eligible voters of the United States decided collectively that this was an election that was important, and one that they believed they ought to participate in. And you know, I find great solace in that fact, that whatever other problems American democracy has, citizens as a whole are still wedded to the process, and their turnout rates in this election is solid evidence of that. To go back to your original question, you know, why did people vote the way they did? Why did so many appear to reject Trump, or perhaps even more surprisingly, why did so many stay with him? I think it's helpful to sort of take a step back and think about vote choice analytically, right? Which is, people sometimes make trade-offs when they vote. There's different things they care about. One of the things that they care about is their ideology, in particular their closeness to one political party or another, and that matters to them to greater or lesser degrees, perhaps at different points in history. The other thing that they care about is their perceptions of the overall competence of the incumbent versus the challenger. And so I think, you know, some of the voters that, that perhaps had previously supported Trump and then went into the Biden column in this election probably did so because of changing perceptions of competence due to economic conditions and to, you know, the spread of COVID-19. But so many did not change one way or the other, surely because of the weight that much of the electorate places now on their own ideology, right? On their own closeness to one political party versus the other, right? So this is polarization, as my colleague just described it. And there is an argument to be made, certainly from the vantage point of somebody like me who studies corruption, that extreme levels of polarization actually can present a real challenge to democratic governance. Right? We want voters, when they're faced with fairly solid evidence of either wrongdoing or incompetence, to be willing to vote against a candidate that they might otherwise ideologically favor. But if the level of polarization in a society is sufficiently high, you're not going to have enough citizens willing to do that. So elections will cease to punish politicians for bad behavior, right? And they'll cease to function as vehicles of accountability. And I think that's really where the threat of polarization rears its head from the vantage point of democratic theory.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, like you find it's hard, you know, from an academic standpoint, if you think about committed left-leaning voters or committed right-leaning voters, like what is the piece of evidence that would get them to vote across party lines? And the answer is there probably isn't very much. And as we have sort of growing camps on those two poles, what that means is that there's sort of a growing segment of the country that would reject evidence of all types that might motivate them to change their mind. And that certainly limits how elections can hold incumbent officials accountable for the sorts of things that they do. So, that seems like a real longstanding threat to the way that we administer government and representation.
And the challenge is when politicians themselves come to perceive that, mm-hmm. right? And then because then their behavior is no longer constrained if they believe that their followers, under no condition, under no behavior that they might exhibit, would be willing to abandon them, right? I mean, the tongue-in-cheek example, sort of the phrase that captures that, and I'm not saying that this is actually relevant for behavior, but the phrase that captures that was Trump's little quip that, you know, I could go out into Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and the voters would stay with me. That's kind of like a phrase that provides a good example of leaders potentially internalizing just how polarized the electorate is and the leeway or the slack that provides them behaviorally. So I think there's two things here, right? There's this polarization, which is potentially undermining democratic accountability. And I do think that it's the case that to some degree it's undermining democratic accountability in the U.S. right now. The other point is the quality of the information that voters are getting and the degree to which they believe they can get unbiased information about the competence and the honesty of politicians, right? And that's a conversation about the changing media environment. When the media is perceived of as falling into distinct camps, then citizens are less likely to unambiguously interpret facts as neutral. They're more likely to interpret pieces of information as having a particular bias, as having a particular spin, and they have the opportunity then to self-select into outlets that provide them essentially with entertainment and the types of information they want to hear as opposed to relatively objective facts. So I'm reminded, Justin, of a period of time with which I'm sure you're familiar, which is the period of time prior to the progressive era in the United States, where news outlets, which were newspapers, were explicitly partisan. The newspaper represented either the Democratic Party or it represented the Republican Party. And that was the time of the greatest corruption and the weakest accountability in American history. So if I take a 30,000 foot view and just look at long periods of history in the United States, I am concerned that the polarized media environment would seem to be reproducing some of the pathologies that we've seen in prior periods of American history.
Dave, can I ask you a question, if it's all right? How have comparative nations, other countries, dealt with sort of backed off of the kind of polarization that we have here, right? Like how have, when other countries have come up against this level of partisan discord, have they sort of turned the ship around? Because I spent a lot of time trying to think about how to turn this boat in the other direction, how to sort of reverse both media polarization and public polarization and elite polarization, and rarely come to very many conclusions that I've got good ideas about.
So, I mean, sadly, one of the answers is just trauma, which is in some of the cases with which I'm most familiar, these levels of increasing polarization actually led to breakdowns in democratic governance. The best known example, of course, would be Chile in 1973, where the government of Salvador Allende is highly controversial. He institutes a series of nationalizations and land reforms. There's protests on the street. He's a president who wins election with a relatively weak popular mandate. The center right turns against him and embraces the extreme right. There's a military coup, and then that leads to obviously the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Fast forward to Chile in the 1990s and Chile today, which is actually undergoing very important institutional reforms. They've just decided to abandon the constitution that was created under the Pinochet dictatorship. I think you get a reduction in polarization just as a function of an appreciation of the national trauma that not backing away from that precipice created, right? I mean, everybody, there was a time when those on the right in Chile would say, yes, Pinochet did a lot of, and I've had people say this to me when I lived there, they would say Pinochet did a lot of bad things, but, we were close to a civil war. He did what he needed to do to save the nation. I'm not saying that there aren't people who still believe that, but people would no longer say that in quote unquote polite company or in public in Chile anymore, because I think there's an appreciation that the effect that those years, those dictatorial years, had was so bad for both sides. It was bad even for the image of the military itself. That's a path nobody is willing to go down anymore. And there's been an alternation since then of left and right, and both the left and the right in Chile, I think, have moderated. The left moderated right away after the end of the dictatorship, and the right in more recent years has moderated as well. And you see that in many countries. In Brazil, it was the same thing, part of the moderation, in spite of the fact that you have somebody like Bolsonaro now, who is kind of a mini Trump and hitting on some of the same tropes and sort of pushing for remembrance of the so-called glories of Brazil's military regime. One of the things that people don't appreciate about all of that is the military itself doesn't want it. Right? As a corporate unit, they have played that game. They have been there and done that, and it was terrible for them and for their image.
Gentlemen, let me ask you real quick. You've mentioned foreign countries. You've now mentioned the Brazilian president. Where do we stand with global acceptance or denial of what's going on here in the United States? The Brazilian president he went in before the 2020 election saying, I hope Trump wins. And now he's had no comment post-election. And we've had Western country leaders calling President-elect Biden and saying congratulations. What about elsewhere in the world?
Dan, fire away. As far as I know, and most of my sort of knowledge comes from Western European countries. Western European countries are largely thinking that this is President-elect Biden's race, and that come January he will take office. The reaction to the rest of the world, I'm honestly a little less familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I my sense is the reaction of most of the world is that Vice President Biden is now President Elect Biden, and I think where you see resistance to that is mostly among a relatively small set of countries where their leaders have governed in a clear populist style and have tried to cast themselves either in the mold of a Trump or have associated themselves very closely with the president and therefore are reticent to do something that would lead them to fall in his bad graces. But I don't see that. I don't interpret what you're seeing, Rick, as the rest of the world having any doubt that Joseph Biden is, in effect, the president-elect of the United States.
We have about a minute before the next break. Do you think that countries who are in support of Biden will just start to call him for conversation rather than calling President Trump?
I suppose if I were an international leader in another country, I would probably start making overtures towards President Biden or President-elect Biden in the hopes that when that transition happens, that we're prepared for a long-term relationship. I
mean, would you call him for to start talking about how to do things? Hmm. Maybe not papers to sign, but for this is how we want to do something on January 21st.
I mean, if I were in those shoes, I would probably hold off a little longer, until some of the concessions from the Republican Party have started. So Vice President Biden hasn't had his first national security briefing yet.
Okay.
And so like that seems wise to me to hold off for a while.
Okay. We need to take our next break. Thanks for listening. We do have our guest today, Professor Daniel Gingrich and Professor Justin Kirkland, as we talk about post-election 2020. Be right back. All right, here we go. The topic everyone's been waiting for, post-election 2020, because you haven't heard it anywhere else, at least not with Professor Justin Kirkland and Daniel Gingrich on the show in the same hour. You haven't. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us again today. Professor Gingrich, one of the things that you do at UVA is you co-direct UVA's CLEAR Lab, Corruption Lab on Ethics, Accountability, and Rule of Law. And you've mentioned or brought up the word corruption several times during the show. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Clear Lab?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to, Rick. So the Clear Lab is one of a series of rotating labs that make up a relatively new initiative at the University of Virginia, which is within the College of Arts and Sciences, and that's the initiative called the Democracy Initiative. So the Democracy Initiative was created in order to make the University of Virginia an internationally recognized powerhouse in the study of governance, the quality of governance, both in the United States and around the world. So our lab focuses on one critically important challenge to the quality of governance, and that is corruption. Corruption can be thought of as the original and perhaps the classic pathology of governance, in particular democratic governance, found around the world. So our lab is made up of a group of researchers with backgrounds that really run the gamut. So as I mentioned to you, my expertise is in Latin America. I've spent a substantial amount of time in a variety of countries in South America investigating corruption, Brazil, Chile, Bolivia, others. I've also worked in Central America. There are individuals who belong to the lab whose expertise lies in India, others who focus on Indonesia, those who focus on jurisprudence surrounding bribery in the United States, those who look at corruption from a historical perspective. So a very broad interdisciplinary group of faculty interested in issues like the influence of money in politics, how can it be constrained, issues like formal democratic institutional design, how do voting systems affect corruption, how do voting systems affect behaviors like vote buying, and what context do they contribute to these phenomena, and what context do they make them less likely. In addition to our research efforts, Rick, we are also involved in extensive teaching and public outreach that we've held some important large events. Last year, we held an event at the Miller Center where we brought in William Browder, who is for a time one of the largest foreign investors in Russia. He was responsible for the Magnitsky Act, which you may recognize as placing sanctions on human rights violators in Russia, particularly individuals who are linked to the Putin regime. He came and talked to UVA as part of the activities of our lab, was interviewed by David Gergen. So we're a very active group. And one of the things that we're doing now that I think would be of interest to your listeners, we're just starting a project which is looking at COVID relief funding in the United States, the Paycheck Protection Program, and other aspects of COVID relief that are part of the CARES Act and others. And we're going to try to increase transparency surrounding the allocation of funds from CARES and other COVID relief efforts. So we just got some money from the Democracy Initiative to create a dashboard, which will create a user-friendly interface for citizens to be able to see how PPP funds are being used in their county or their state, because this was really an enormous program, $2.3 trillion, one of the largest relief program in American history. And transparency regarding the use of those funds is really lacking. So we felt that it was incumbent upon us as a lab that focuses on corruption, which is often a function of lack of transparency, to try to improve the transparency surrounding that program. So that's one of the many different activities that we're involved with as a lab. And if you're interested, I'd be happy to talk more about some of the different research projects we're involved with.
Well, I have a question that sort of ties into that. I'd like to ask Professor Kirkland, as we talk about corruption. I'm curious, at what point does the waiting or the pushing for the voting count confirmation and the claims of corruption move from proof of accuracy to what some are calling the decimation of the system?
Yeah, that's both an excellent and difficult question to answer. So I would sort of start out by saying that if a candidate for office suspects irregularities, it is certainly within their right to request an audit of outcomes. There's nothing particularly untoward about that. The problem is emerges when pressure of a political type is placed on audits to change results in some meaningful way. But simply recounting the balance and looking for accuracy, I mean, that's certainly within the legal rights of any candidate seeking office. The trouble, I think, with a demand for recounts without any meaningful evidence of fraud is that, I mean, we've already got emerging public opinion numbers suggesting that those requests for recount without evidence are harming the legitimacy with which elections are conducted in the United States. Citizens have a decreasing faith that elections are the right way to govern the country. And that seems to be tied pretty closely to supporters for President Trump and his efforts to question the legitimacy of elections that were conducted. So, I mean, I'm not sure where the line is that, you know, requesting a recount or requesting an audit without evidence becomes itself problematic. When does it sort of create other downstream problems? Well, that's already happening. That didn't take very long to begin at all. So that's the sort of best I can do on that. That's a good question, and one I don't know that we are particularly well equipped to answer right now, because this is the first time we've been through something quite like this before.
And Professor Gingrich, your specialty is South American countries, but just in the last few days, U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo has said the U.S. is concerned about votes in Myanmar. How does the U.S. make commentary on other countries' elections, whether they're in Africa, in South America, or elsewhere in the world, when the world's eyes are upon the U.S. and its own election? Where does this fall in the hands of the CLEAR Lab?
So they make that commentary with much less weight and less regard than those words had in previous years. They're just not nearly as influential, I think, today as they might have been in the past. An important point to make about election systems that many people might not appreciate is that, in fact, you know, in many countries in South America, the election systems actually function much more smoothly than they do here in the United States. You know, when Brazil holds a presidential election, voting is all electronic. All of the systems are integrated, so you can find out who the president is within hours of the closing of polls of the election. And they are not, you know, certainly at the national level, the votes themselves are just not contested after the fact anymore. Sometimes the behavior prior to the election, campaign financing, where people are getting money from, that is hotly contested and the subject of many investigations and judicial processes. But the vote itself is generally not contested and accepted by all parties. So I want to make the point that in fact, maybe we have quite a bit to learn from other countries south of the border about how to organize an election. Of course, you know, the American historical experience is election administration is decentralized, and every state does it a different way, and that makes it very difficult. And I understand that. But some countries certainly do it more efficiently than we do, and that should be appreciated. I wanted, Rick, if I might, to go back to this issue that Justin raised about how to think about these claims of fraud. I agree that any politician who believes that he or she was the victim of irregularities in the voting process has the right to ask for judicial review and potentially a recount depending on the circumstance. But I want to underline that I think it's highly unethical and highly damaging to the democratic system as such for any politician or any group of politicians to openly claim that there is systematic fraud without having evidence of that. Okay, right? It's fine to ask for judicial review if one has evidence. But if one does not have evidence, to use claims of systematic fraud to try to mobilize voters or try to mobilize one's base for other purposes is highly unethical and quite damaging to democracy as such.
I mean, you see that damage playing out now, right? Like, I mean, we see, you know, the most recent numbers I've seen have shown the Republican Party's faith in American elections has been cut in half since early November. We're only in mid-November now. So that's a really precipitous drop really fast.
And it's not just the election process. I think since our current administration has taken over with all the regular commentary, the same thing has happened with traditional media.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're without media sort of oversight. The media is sort of the fourth institution of American government without faith in elections, with constant claims of, you know, bias and fraud that aren't supported by evidence. Dan's right. You put your sort of democratic norms in a really difficult position to recover from. So,
as we wind down our hour, I want to toss this out there again to our guests today, Professor Justin Kirkland, Professor Daniel Gingrich, UVA's Department of Politics. So from the majority of information that I've read, and I do try and read multiple sides of things, because it's not just two, there were no major concern, no major problems with global interference in the 2020 election. But will we ever be able to better prevent inaccurate social media statements and theories? Professor Kirkland, do you want to start?
I suppose I should comment on it. I don't know that I want to start. I mean, I guess my response is I don't know what that looks like. I worry very deeply about the influence of social media on American politics and what it has the power to do. And I just don't have a great view of what it looks like to regulate that speech. So there are some folks at Washington University in St. Louis, Jacob Montgomery, a friend of mine, who's doing a project. And the purpose of the project is to see whether people can identify a political ad when it's aired, right? If we can come to some sort of shared definition of what is political. And Jacob's early results suggest that citizens can't even agree on what a political ad is, much less how to regulate it and then how to judge whether it's accurate or not accurate. And so, like, the challenge of regulating social media discussion and social media commentary and social media advertising just seems really overwhelming, but really important to me.
But Professor Gingrich, I mean, it doesn't matter who you voted for. everyone would agree that conspiracy theories and fake news spread faster than real facts. What do you do?
Unfortunately, there's some clear evidence that in fact that is the case, that fake news and conspiracy theories are shared more, they're disseminated more quickly via social media than legitimate stories are. It is a very difficult question and problem to tackle. And here's the issue: you do not want falsehoods to go unaddressed and uncorrected, because if they do, then again, democratic elections can't serve this function of accountability. Right, politicians and parties can't be held accountable if there's no means of disseminating what they do in an objective way to people who vote for or against them. Right. On the other hand, everybody has interests, and this is where the sort of the critique of regulation, self-regulation by the social media companies comes into play, right? Social media companies have their own financial considerations, and that clearly may feed into how they eventually try to regulate forms of political speech. So there may be something to be said for, if there is regulation of social media companies, having individuals or groups other than those companies themselves play a role in that regulation.
Gentlemen, January 20th, do you think that President Biden will be in the White House?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So we have to call this show finished for this week. I want to thank Professors Justin Kirkland and Professor Daniel Gingrich for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed myself a lot. Thanks, Rick.
It was a lot of fun, Rick. Thanks for having me.
All right. Everybody, tune in again next Sunday. Thanks very much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.